Okay, Luke 24:25, and he said unto them, O fools and slow of heart to believe all that the prophets have spoken of on Christ, to have suffered these things and to enter into his glory. Being and Moses and all the prophets expounded them in all the scriptures, the things concerning himself. And then verse 44, these are the words, one logon, or logos, which I spake unto you while I was yet with you, that all things must be fulfilled, which were written in the law of Moses and in the prophets and in the Psalms concerning me. Then he opened their understanding that they might understand the scriptures. So we say the logos is a sui nemi of the scriptures. The logos is a sui nemi of the scriptures. That is when you put the scriptures together. Same thing, Nehemiah 8:7-8. So how important is employing an hermeneutic? Jesus has done that here. So we can say that hermeneutic is also a study of the historical context. Are we right? Huh? Grammatical context, historical context, then the theological implications. So you must know the grammar and then the context historically, and of course the grammatical implications. Also, the ability to make separations. I think we should appreciate those who put the Bible in verses. I guess what they have done, which we must say without sounding condescending, as we might have done unknowingly before, is that the use of verses by the Bible translators itself shows us that we must, in our reading of scripture, find out how the paragraphs ought to have been outlaid. Whilst we might, in one or two instances or more, disagree with the way they have phrased it, it therefore calls us to action, that on a regular basis, as much as we use the text in their references, the verses, we are also compelled to find the right paragraphs of concepts, themes, and expressions. It has to be a duty we'll undertake regularly. Our understanding of history is therefore of utmost importance. Education also plays a major role in what we do. I said yesterday something I mentioned, I think some of you didn't get it. So I just want to go over it very briefly. And that is the Abel's offering. Genesis 8. Just 4, sorry. So I don't think we should have much ado in tussling what happened in Noah's flood vis-a-vis whether it was a global. I think it's of lesser importance. Some have said it's a local flood, like the tsunami. Some have said it was just in a particular area. I think it's irrelevant. I don't think it's worth pulling hairs over. If it's in other historical records, that means it happened. I can't write something that happens in my world I have cognitive abilities to now know what happens elsewhere. So I think it's of no importance for me. Did it happen? Yes, it did. And like I've said, it's a book of believing. Jesus referenced it. And it was not just referenced by Jesus. So to show that that historical fact was not just a case of being in the Pentateuch, it was historical and accepted by Jesus. Peter made references to it and the writer of Hebrews. So I think it's not an issue that one should pull over. And this drives me to think with us on the issue of Abel. And I would, first of all, let us look at the mindset of Abel's sacrifice. I think, once again, we are confronting a mindset. And that mindset is the theology of sacrifice, where it is believed that man sinned against God and he couldn't pay. So, because he couldn't pay, God knowing that he couldn't pay, and God is a God of justice. He can't but be just, but he's a loving God. So because he's a loving God, he goes to the side of the sinner and then pays the price that he demanded for himself for the sinner. It looks nice to think that way, but it creates a lot of challenges. If we might know who created the system of sacrifice, they say it's the same God. They say then he puts man in the position to give the sacrifice. They say yes. At what point did he create the sacrifice? When man sinned. Why did man, what was man sin? He sinned. What did he do? They say he didn't believe in the sacrifice. Cool down. So, there will be a lot of complexities, and I think because as in the Reformation age, it was, I said that yesterday, I think. Did I? It was able to answer their questions of, we don't need to go to the priest, the Catholic priest for forgiveness. We don't need the indulgences and all that. The judge shall live by faith, even though apparently that interpretation by Martin Luther, which we have carried on for years, didn't carry the entire picture. And, you know, they were answering questions of penance, indulgences, the Catholic monasteries, buildings, cathedrals, the issue of purgatory. So that was what they were answering. And the only way out was to provide that answer, that there is faith in God should take care of what you are doing. And it's cool. Yeah, it is. It answers the question. I think, like I've said yesterday, we must answer today's questions with the same theology, but not answer their questions. Because obviously it wasn't a full picture. And I want to carefully say this because I don't want to be seen saying what I don't want to say. But when you also look at the interventions of people like Kenneth Hagin, you discover that yes, they answered questions of their day. But I'm not sure that those questions, I'm talking about the faith message now, believe in your heart, say with your mouth, if God has said something, believe his word, and all of that. But I'm not sure it captured every theme of theology. So we always meet up with one roadblock or the other, but why does this happen? Why does that happen? The concept of long life protection, the concept of miracles, everything just meets a brick wall at some point because of not having that fuller picture. Of course, Brother Hagin did do well in bringing many things together in theology, so I must make an exception there. But we do have a duty to look at scriptures properly. And not that mindset of sacrifice, atonement, God is angry, he needs to be pacified. Man cannot do it. God comes as a man. He stands for man. Then the question that brings is even worse. Because the man that God sent, Jesus, who is God, was equally killed. And he was killed by men. So we say he was killed by men. Then we go, no. God put the sins of humanity on him. Then you say, how? So God put the sins from one corner and then put... It all just has a good number of roadblocks. And shall I say landmines. So in answering the Reformation age questions, I think a lot of problems came out of it. And so you'll find out that then they evolved with the Calvinism theory. God chose something. And you know, it all goes a wire at some point, the sovereignty of God. We must therefore renegotiate it, we must rework it, reevaluate it, we must look at it again. Like I said, if you look at what it has birthed many of the Protestant denominations, birthed even charismatic churches, word of faith churches. So those things were subsumed into theologies without the relevant studies and questions. and the damage of the prosperity materials takes even critical thinking off the sail. They are just a way. And so we are in a pandemic situation that people can't put together coherent thoughts. It's either we don't know what God is doing, or we know what God is doing, and both look very funny. In fact, interestingly, one preacher, a prominent preacher in Nigeria, said God is testing people, trying people. Then his son, another prominent preacher, said it is the devil. And as much as we can laugh over that, but the truth is, they both presented what the evangelical church in Africa, Nigeria, Pentecostal Charismatic, how we think. We don't know at what point to say it's the devil or say it is God. We don't even know where to say it is man. We think that man somewhere is a pawn between God and the devil. Again, how we are different from Job for me is a revelation. So Genesis 4 will be a story. And we must find the theology there. That is the Cain and Abel narrative. I must commit myself to sincerity here by saying that in reading Jesus and Paul, and John and the writer of Hebrews, I really had to go back to Genesis 4 with a mindset. So I'm helped by their studies, I'm helped by what they wrote, but to observe that the concept of sacrifice, which we have tied to God asking for something. One. And also, there's this link, and I put it here, and we must debunk it. That in the Garden of Eden, God clothed Adam and Eve, verse 21, with coats of skin. They were naked. So the assumption is that they didn't have clothes, no underwears. Then God now takes and then clothes them. Then we say that that was where God first killed an animal. So you say God was, we don't understand that that concept implies that by the first death was have come from God. He killed an animal and put the animal blood on there. So they say why? So that they can stand before God's presence. And then after doing that, he sends them out of Garden. And they say, oh, come on. You know, after he had put the sacrifice himself, he's still not satisfied. He sends them out of Garden of Eden. Look at this. Too many gaps in there. That because the children knew that, so because Cain and Abel knew that, so it was therefore odd that Cain would bring from the ground the fruit where Abel brought from the animal sacrifice. The implication of that is very, very far-fetched. But all this is just imaginations. Without doubt, the Genesis 3:21 cannot be read outside the nakedness of man and all of that. We'll probably see that again. But in Genesis chapter 4, we have to have a background to it, that there's Genesis 3:15, the seed of the woman, the Zera, will bruise the head of the serpent. I would say that that implies a person, a group, descendants, a family or a nation. Then Genesis 4:1, Adam knew his wife, she conceived. This is critical. Before you get to Cain and Abel's offering, this must come in. He bore Cain and said, I have gotten a man from the Lord. I have gotten a man from Yahweh. So, Genesis 4:2, she bore again his brother Abel. Abel was a keeper of sheep. If you are Moses, or if you are in Moses' audience, then notice those who are in that tradition of keeper of sheep. We have Abraham and Moses himself. Ra, where you have shepherd. Antison, that's R-A-A-H. Antison for sheep, T-S-O-N. Presupposes that Moses is bringing in theology. You have Adam was meant to keep and till the garden. Genesis chapter 2, verse 15. And then you have Abel to keep sheep. To keep sheep, which in scripture is contrast to serpents. Contrast to evil. And you have all that in Matthew 10 also. Sheep among wolves. So you have all that. You must read that together. Then he says, Abel, or Cain, brought the fruit of the ground and offered the Lord. And said, well, God caused the ground. That's the problem. But what about the animals? I think it's ridiculous to think that way. Abel brought the firstling of his flock. Again, we throw away the fact that the A-N-E writings didn't have this pronoun. And I didn't find it in the Hebrew at all. So he brought forward what you have called the Bekorah, B-E-K-O-R-A-H, which in the Hebrew is the right of the firstborn. The right of the firstborn. In the book of Genesis, that word Bekorah was not used for animals. Genesis 25 verse 31. And look at the emphasis. I want you to observe something. Please look up. Before you write, please. The next mention of this, now we have Cain and Abel. One is the first son. The other is the second. And the A-N-E, you pass the right of ministry, rulership to the first. So, what Adam was meant to do, Cain should do it. Does that make sense? I've gotten a man from Lord Genesis 3:15. Your seed will bruise the head of serpent. So that already presupposes that the concept of authority to the first son is even in the theology of Genesis 3:15. Okay, so now, let's keep Abel and Cain and go to another contrast. Also another parallel here. Or is it contrast, parallel, examples. Will be Jacob and Esau. Again, the first is Esau, not Jacob. And this is the second time the word Bekorah is repeated. And see, sell me today your birthright. Bekorah. Right of the firstborn. And then Esau said, behold, I'm at the point to die, and profit shall this birthright do to me. Jacob said, swear to me this day, and swore unto him, and he sold his birthright unto Jacob. Jacob gave Esau bread and pottage of lentils. I wonder how sweet that is. He did eat and drink and rose up and went his way, and thus he despised as Esau his birthright. Genesis 27:36. Is it not rightly named Jacob? For he has supplanted me these two times. He took away my birthright, and behold, now he has taken away my blessing. I don't understand how he separated it. And he said, hast thou not reserved a blessing for me? Genesis 43 verse 33. And they sat before him, the firstborn according to his birthright, the youngest according to his youth, and the men marveled one at another. So Bekorah, now let's go to Genesis 4 and say, Abel brought the firstborn right of his flock. The only reasonable explanation is Abel believed in Genesis 3:15. Because the firstborn here, now, this word in Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers is now interplayed with the use of bringing an animal sacrifice or animal offering. Pardon me, I changed that back. It is from the Hebrew word bakar, B-A-K-A-R, which is a new fruit, something new. It therefore presupposes that what Abel did, that's why when we read about blood in Genesis 4, it is his blood when he was killed. Genesis 4 verse 10 and verse 11. And when Jesus is going to reference this, we studied this before, the reference was to the mother of Abel. Abel's blood has always been his mother. Matthew 23, verse 35. The blood of righteous Abel. Tzedekah, righteous Abel. Okay? Matthew 24, 35. 1 John 3, 12. So when we read the blood that speaks better things than Abel, Hebrews 12, 24, is the blood of Jesus. Who's following what I'm saying here? Are you getting this? He's not talking about being martyred. So what then is in Genesis 4? What is Moses saying? We won't get it till we look at the other things. God accepted. Now, listen carefully to what I'm about to say. Again, the English makes it look like two of them brought something. Okay? And then God says, I take this one. For what purpose, we don't know. But the Hebrew word here is the word shah. S-H-A-A-H. It's means to see, so it has to do with what you see, what you viewed, or what you saw. Genesis 31, verse 1. Genesis 32, verse 3. Sorry, I think I'm mixing up my text. Alright, Genesis 41:10. Oh God. Okay. No. It's Genesis 41:23. Behold seven stars. What he beheld. Okay. Exodus 5:9. Please remind me to supply the other text. Exodus 5:9. Please remind me. Let them not regard vain words. Exodus 5:9. 2 Samuel 22:42. Job 7:19. Second Samuel 22:42. Let me check that. They looked And there's none to say but even unto the Lord, but he answered them not. Job 7:19. How would thou not depart from me? Let me alone till would thou not depart from me? That means to regard me. Job 14:6. Turn from him that he may rest. That is, look not at him. Then Psalm 19:17. Psalm 39:13. I have to check all these texts again. I think I mixed up with something. 39:13. Spare me. Oh, spare me that I may recover strength. The word spare there means regard me. So, in Genesis 4, when it says the Lord accepted, it meant regard. To consider. The word add respect there means to consider, to look. Now let's look at the word offering, which is very critical in this respect. Is the word minkah, M-I-N-C-H-A-H. It is not used for sacrifice. It is used for tribute or a gift, and it is voluntary. Genesis 32:13. A lot there came and took of the present, which came to his hand, a present for Esau his brother. A present. Verse 18. They be thy servant Jacob, it is a present sent unto my Lord Esau, and behold also is behind us. Verse 21. So went the present over before him and himself lodged in the right company. Genesis 33:10. Nay, I pray that if I have found grace in thy sight, then receive my present at my hand, for therefore I have seen thy face. Genesis 43:11. Take the best fruits in the land in your vessels, and carry them in man a present, a little balm, a little honey. Genesis 43:15. The men took the prayer and they took double money in their hand. Genesis 43:25. They made ready the present against Joseph, came at noon, and then they came, they should eat bread there. Genesis 43:26. So present there is a gift. It's not, there's nothing so far in the book of Genesis that presents it as a sacrificial thing. You killed an animal. It's used as a tribute. And therefore, Genesis 4, verse 5, the firstlings of whose flock? It has to be the firstlings of God's flock, which is what he presents before the Lord, is faith in the gift and the sacrifice of Jesus. Now, when you read Hebrews 11 and verse 4, by faith, Abel offered phosphorus, the Greek word there, prospero. And look at prospero too in Matthew 2:11. It's to offer a gift, a more excellent sacrifice than Cain. Pleon. Pleon is used here, P-L-E-O-I-N, in Hebrews 3:3. For this man was counted worthy of more glory than Moses. That's Jesus. Hebrews 7:23. Truly, there were many priests because they were not continued to suffer to. They were not suffered to continue by the reason of death. So, what we have in Hebrews 11:4, I use the word Hebrews 12:24 again. Jesus, the mediator of a new covenant, to the blood of sprinkling that speaks better, the word kraton, better from Abel, the word there is paraton Abel, that is from that of Abel. So the blood of Jesus speaks from Abel is a proper rendition of that text. So therefore, if you look at Genesis chapter 4, there is an imagery of Abel's faith and reliance on God's gift. It is not the introduction of sacrificial offering to God by clean animals. We'll see that in Noah. We'll see that in Abraham. Why? Because it is in their culture. But what Abel did here is faith in God's promise in Genesis 3:15. And so men began to call upon the name of the Lord through Enosh. Is that clear? Saith Enosh. So that's where the issue of worship and the activities and ceremonies came from. But before then, what we have here is an imagery used by Moses to say, this man believes in the gift of the firstborn, of God's firstborn in his creation, which is Jesus. And obviously Cain didn't have that. So Hebrews 11:4 says he has a more excellent sacrifice than Cain, in that his gifts testify that he being dead, he speaks. His gifts. So therefore, in our exegesis, we must be careful in making all those mindset submissions. I'll quickly run through some things. And why it is vital to always look at the context of history. If, for example, we know that the issue of ceremonies and worship did not start until when men began to call upon the name of the Lord, and then we trace it to the Noah era, then we definitely will know that there was no ceremony in Hebrews 4. What we eventually find in Hebrews 4, and look up, let me point out something again. Because Moses uses imageries, he will therefore use imageries that they recognize in their world. Okay, but by the time you read that men began to call upon the name of the Lord through Enosh, then you will calm down and say, this is an imagery or a figure of speech used by Moses. History is always important in our study. Let's look at an example. 1 Timothy chapter 2. As much as we have tried to, I remember somebody wrote this particular commentary, I think on Amazon, on the book Women of God, and said, well, the book carries a lot of misogyny, that as we are saying that the woman and man are the same in Christ, how come we are now still presupposing that in marriage and all of that? But one of the texts that people oftentimes refer to is 1 Timothy 2. And there's something that will also bail us out there in our proper concentration. 1 Timothy 2:11, let the woman learn in subjection, in silence and with all subjection, but I suffer not a woman to teach, not to usurp authority over the man, but to be in silence. Now, without even going into context and grammar, I think by using the word usurp, already shows a prevalent problem. The epistles were oftentimes written to answer questions and resolve issues with the theology of the Old Testament centered around Jesus. Now, a careful look at that word that Paul employs here in 1 Timothy 2:12 is constructed like this. Epitrepo, aude, auton ten, andros. The key word there is the word aiton ten. A-U-T-H-E-N-T-E-O, auton teo. A-U-T-H-E-N-T-E-O. And I'm wondering, is the only time you will find this in any of the Paul's letters? It doesn't even have a synonym. And there are two words that this carries. One of them is the word entrea. E-N-T-E-E or E-N-T-R-E-A. It means to bear an armor, to literally carry arms. I won't suffer a woman, in other words, to be armed towards her husband. Again, Paul employs a lot of literary device here, the technique. That leads us to know, so whenever you see questions like this, you say, well, who is he writing to Timothy? Where is Timothy? Timothy is in Ephesus, 1 Timothy 1:3. You know, the other day we said that to understand the Corinthians' problem in 1 Corinthians 11 is the fact that there was no, that's why Paul says that just like angels, there was no distinction. Women were acting anyhow, just like the laws of dressing, Deuteronomy had to do with when they go to Canaan, there was already a lot of sexual rights, obscenities, excesses, gay, homosexuality. So the law was meant to, you know, regulate that. So when you also come here, the question is, in 1 Corinthians 11, what was the real issue? He said a woman should honor her husband, submit to her husband, as the husband submits to Christ. You know, he sets that. Then he goes into the culture of dressing. Whilst in today's world, the dressing is not our problem. But then we have the theology, which might not now address dressing, but might address other things. Does it make sense? Huh? So, in 1 Timothy 2, therefore, it will drive us to see what could have been prevalent in Ephesus for this instruction. It is said that this is why some did argue that Paul's instructions to be bishops did not capture women. I disagree with that because it's construction. But look at this issue. Obviously, there was a prevalent culture in Ephesus. Acts 19. Idolatry. And look at what was being worshipped in Ephesus. Acts 19. The major object of worship was a woman. Acts 19 verse 28, 27. So that not only This our craft is in danger to be set at naught, but also the temple of the great goddess Diana should be despised, and our magnificence should be destroyed, whom all Asia and the world worships. When they heard the sayings, they were full of wrath and cried out, saying, Great is Diana of the Ephesians, And the whole city was filled with confusion, having caught Gaius and Aristarchus, men of Macedonia, Paul's companions in travel. They rushed with one accord into the theater. And the Paul would have entered into with the people, the disciples offered him not. And the certain of the chief of the Asia, which were with his friends, sent unto him, desiring that he would not adventure himself into the theater. Some therefore cried one thing, some other, for the assembly was confused. And some part knew not wherefore they were come together. And they drew Alexander out of the multitude, the Jews putting him forward. And Alexander beckoned with the hand and would have made his defense on the people. When they knew that he was a Jew, all with one voice would cry, about the speed of 2 hours, cried, Great is Diana of the Ephesians. Verse 35, And when the town clerk had appeased the people, he said, Ye men of Ephesus, what man is there that knows not how the city of Ephesus, Ephesians, is a worshipper of the great goddess Diana and of the image which fell down from Jupiter? Seeing then that these things cannot be spoken against, you ought to be quiet and to do nothing rashly. For you have brought either these men, which are neither robbers of churches, nor yet blasphemers of your goddesses. Wherefore, if Demetrius and the craftsmen which are with him have a matter against any man, the law is open, and their deputies, let them imprint one another. If we acquire anything concerning other matters, it shall be determined in lawful assembly, all that. So, we do did have the worship of a goddess. And you find that word Artemis used for Diana, Acts 19:24, Acts 19:28, Acts 19:34, and Acts 19:35. So, one of the things that that brought about was women acting in dominion over their husbands. And Paul says, this cannot be permitted in the churches. So to drive that into the concept of women should not preach is totally not Pauline. 1 Corinthians 11, women will preach or prophesy in the church. 1 Corinthians 14:26, 1 Timothy 3 and all of that. And look at Paul's associates. So the issue was, there was a culture, a woman uprising against men, that Paul was addressing. That's why he used the word that I mentioned earlier, which is to bear arms, to be violent against. It shows, therefore, in exegesis and Bible teaching and interpretation, we must ask the question, what is the question that this answer was meant for? You cannot remove Paul's regular, consistent mention of women in his epistles from his theology. The practice already shows nothing in his letters could have implied that Paul is instructing women not to teach. Romans 16, we are juniors, verse 7. We have many people in Romans 16. In fact, Romans 16, she is an apostle. We had Priscilla and Aquila, Romans 16:3, obviously women who were teaching. All the Lucan stories about women, Luke 10, Mary at the feet of Jesus. Or you look at Mary Magdalene, John 20, who brought the gospel to the apostles. Or you hear that the reason why Jesus rebuked his disciples for being foolish was because they did not believe the gospel of the women. Therefore, you cannot submit to a narrow and biased interpretation of 1 Timothy 2:11 and 12 to make any submissions of the Bible being against women. So a few other questions that we might be have to drive ourselves to answer will be the essence of wars. I know we've taken some distance on that. But we must see the wars of the Old Testament, the legitimate ones, as redemptive violence. Redemptive violence in a fallen world with fallen men and increasingly growing theology. The context of that is simple. By the time you look at why Moses gave the laws, you ask yourself, what is the theology of it? The theology of all the laws is in the first 10, the ones described as given by the finger of God. And in Matthew 5, when Jesus said, you have heard of old, now I say to you, it meant that in Jesus' exegesis, it lets us see the historical background of the laws of Moses. It wasn't original with Moses. It was a law of the land that Moses put theology into and adjusted. Don't do this, don't do that. Jesus said, now I say this to you, Matthew 5. So those laws kept evolving, the customs kept evolving, but the theology never changed. God remains unchanging, His faithfulness remains the same in all the generations. And this leads us to look at Psalm 106. I know we've been there before, but it's good to check it again. Psalm 106, where a man by the name of Phineas, in verse 30, so then stood up Phineas and executed. Now, we can start from verse 22. Wondrous works in the land of Am, and terrible things by the Red Sea. Therefore, he said that he would destroy them, and had not Moses chosen stood before him in his breach to turn away his wrath, lest he should destroy them. Yea, they despised the pleasant land, they believed not his word, but murmured in their tents and hearkened not of the voice of the Lord. Therefore, he lifted up his hand against them. He overthrew them in the wilderness to overthrow their seed also among the nations and to scatter them in the lands. They joined themselves, pay attention here, unto Baal Peor and ate the sacrifice of the dead. Thus they provoked him to anger and their intentions and their plague breaking upon them. Then stood up Phineas and executed judgment. So, if you look at that story, Numbers 25, I think Pastor Lang is your area there. Numbers 25. Now, without a bias of the person of Jesus, alright, in Numbers 25, when Phineas comes up, and that's verse 27, he rose up, took a javelin in his hand, and went after the man of Israel in the tent. There are two people who were having sex right there in the tabernacle. Two of them. Then, a man and a woman, he thrust it through their belly. The plague was taken from the children of Israel. And those that died in the plague were 20 and 4,000. Now, without the bias of the person of Jesus, if you were a Jew in the worship of God and somebody comes to the tabernacle, they begin to have sex and have idol worship, you know, and then one brother gets up in the church, brings out a spear, and goes, pshew. We'll say, thank God for him. We're all looking at that. Like you said, without the bias of Jesus. And he does that, you know, and the plague ceased. Now, in today's world, you can't even do that. Because of theology, because of worship. But in their world, what he did was redemptive in nature. And God used everything, including things that it had to be permissible in the tenses, like an ark, like a tabernacle. And therefore, here we have Phineas, and I want you to observe something. The writer here, a psalmist, says, and that was, verse 31, counted unto him for righteousness. And here we have judgment. And we must come to a day where we'll explore this well in the coming days, and we need it. The word he uses there, chasab, to think of, is the same Hebrew word in Genesis 15:6. Abraham believed in the Lord. It was chesab, counted to him for righteousness. Genesis 31:15, Genesis 38:15, and Genesis 50:20, where he says, what you thought were evil, God, what you meant for evil, Genesis 50 verse 20. You thought evil against me, God meant it unto good. So, you thought evil against me, Chasab, God meant it for good. Chasab. Now, let us think through this very well. That Jesus says, don't bring out the javelin to kill anybody. Okay? So, we find somebody do that in the worship of God. Let me look at a lower interpretation, corroboration, Romans 14. A guy says, I'm not eating herbs in the worship of God. And we know that the issue of herbs, pay attention please, and the issue of day was loaned or borrowed culture from the A&E. Yet Paul says, if he's doing it unto the Lord, if he has believed the gospel, and he's doing it unto the Lord, you know, let it be his persuasion. So that drives us to say, it was accounted to him by who? The people saw it as righteous. Who's following what I'm saying here? It does not mean that, oh, God wanted him to do it. But in the eyes of the people, and in that context, what he did was right. If you do it now, it's not right. Does that make sense? So, and that brings in all the wars of their war. We've done that, that war was a part of their wars. And also, such actions were redemptive in nature in the theology of their day. We have a duty to explore it. And therefore, when Paul in Romans 4 kept using the same word in the Greek, logizomai, accounted to him, I am strongly of the opinion that Paul had Phineas in mind as well. Abraham believed in the Lord. It was therefore written in his account as tzedekah. Phineas thrust the javelin or the spear to those who were committing idol worship and sexual practices in the tabernacle, and it was accounted to him. So in both ways, the writer sees this as, pay attention, Zedekah, according to God's promise of Genesis 3:15. And what Phineas also did is Zedekah, according to the same promise, because he will bruise the head of the serpent. So we must carefully you look at those scenarios and not totally discard them without looking at the theology behind it, even if it is low Christology. There is a dint of Christology there, because when you now come into the epistles, the same redemptive violence is now spiritual. Where Paul, I said yesterday, 2 Corinthians 10:6 says, when we preach, the weapons of our warfare are not carnal, but mighty through God to the pulling down of strongholds, the casting down of every imagination and every high thing that exalts itself against knowledge of God. And he says to avenge all disobedience. So we will not bring out a spear, because now we have the efficient and sufficient in Jesus, but we will preach the word. Does it make sense? So we mustn't be quick to discard the words. Because in their world, all God had were warlike men. They wouldn't see war as evil or violent as we see it today. They'll see it even in the worship of God. But how come God took responsibility? We just said He had a covenant. Right? He had the covenant to be their ally. He had the covenant to be their friend in weakness. He had the covenant to take responsibility. He's still suffering for it today. The responsibility of their frailties and weaknesses. It is a covenant that He has kept. And in His Son Jesus Christ, who is the man in the covenant, we now have clarity as touching the kind of redemptive violence we should engage in. Our theology must never ignore history. History, and what kind of history, and what was permissible and acceptable in their world, must inform the way we think. I'll just say a few things and we close. On the Hebrews 11, I thought yesterday we said that you don't therefore use faith without the faithfulness of God. Was that clear enough? Huh? And our believing in it. I think I said yesterday, okay, I've mentioned the laws. We must therefore, just like Moses, know that the Ten Commandments is the theology behind the amendment of the laws. Are we to discard the 612 laws? No. We are to study it and understand it and know the theology behind the amendment, which we call the spirit of it. We won't do Phineas, but we will stop idolatry. We won't bring out a spear, but we will cast out the wicked person or the wicked thing amongst us. We will not kill anyone, but by the Spirit will mortify the deeds of the body, Romans 6, 12 and 13, and we walk in the Spirit and don't fulfill the lusts of the flesh. We must glean theology from the imperfect practices of the Old Testament. The great expectation of the Jews, of Israel, Isaiah 40 verse 1, comfort, comfort ye my people, the word Nakam. Why? Because He said, behold Israel your God. So when Jesus uses the word Allos Parakletos, the same comforter, in John 14, either you read from 16, 17, John 15, He's referring to that Paraclete, God coming as a man and dwelling with and in man. So Hebrews 11 for us is to look at the imperfect history and imperfect men, yet a perfect ending, a perfect message. They without us could not be teleotis or teleotis, teleolitis or teleotis, yeah, which is, this is the conclusion of it. The goal remains Jesus. God commends His own kingdom through Jesus. Before then, we had history of that theology scattered in human frailties and human weaknesses. But in Jesus, we find God's perfect man in deeds, in culture, takes away the shadows, takes away the imperfections, and shows us the true project. The kingdom starts with Jesus. And how? It starts with the meek, the poor in spirit, the gentle, the non-violent, the forgiving, and those who reconcile easily. Matthew 5. Those who are not hypocrites, who fast and pray before men, those who have the sufficient food, those who don't seek what the Gentiles seek, those who don't judge others wrongly, John 7, Matthew 7, those who are not false prophets. And when we hear those things and build it upon what He has, build our lives upon what He has said, we build a temple for God. He that hears these sayings of mine and does them is likened unto a man that builds. That's a temple. And the other one doesn't believe, doesn't do it, he also builds. and is not God's temple. God's temple will be eternal. When the winds come, when the rains come, or man's temple will crash. Jesus therefore gives us project kingdom, and it starts with Jesus. He is the stone that the builders rejected, has now become the head of the corner. So, we must accept the frailty of the history and the men, the inefficiencies of the men, inconsistencies. We'll see the violence, we'll see the human frailties that subsumed or subsumed in their world, but in God's faithfulness, we'll see the theology which we have to steal. So when Jesus on the road to Emmaus said, "This is about me," we know the journey he took. Amen.